The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Here with us, he's the Frank H. Marks Visiting Associate Professor of Law and an Administrative Fellow at George Washington University's Law School. He's got an LLB from the National Law School of India University and an MPhil from Oxford University. And after graduating from law school, Professor Bashir joined Anand and Anand, which is a leading intellectual property law firm in New Delhi, where he worked in a variety of contentious and non-contentious IP matters before moving to the firm's IT and telecommunications law division. And we're delighted that he's here today to talk to us about yet another controversial matter, which is India's new drug law and how it affects new chemical entities. So with that, I'm not.
Thank you, Josh, for that kind introduction. I'm going to be reflecting on India's new patent regime and how it's made or not made use of some of the TRIPS flexibilities in that regard. So broadly speaking, what I want to really focus on is what are the kind of safeguards that are currently present in the Indian patent regime to ensure the production of cheap and affordable generics, which, as most of you know, is crucial to ensuring access to medicines. And again, as most of you know, India has gained the status of being a low-cost supplier of generics for most of the world. And in 2005, because of TRIPS obligations, India had to introduce product patents for pharmaceuticals. And the interesting question then is, how is that going to impact access? How is that going to impact generic production in the country and all of that? So in 2005, when India introduced product patents for pharmaceuticals, it wasn't just a blanket introduction of product patents. Rather, a number of safeguards were provided that would continue to ensure that there was some scope still left for the generic producers to exploit some of the TRIPS flexibilities and continue producing generics. The question now is, what are these safeguards and how well do they fit within the TRIPS framework? Or in other words, would any of them contravene TRIPS? And if so, what are the implications if it does contravene TRIPS? So first, I'm just going to start with giving a broad historical background to this whole talk to give you a sense of how the Indian patent regime, at least vis-a-vis pharmaceuticals, has been evolving. So contrary to popular misconception, India had product patents much earlier. It had it since the late 1800s right up to 1970. And guess what? There was no pharmaceutical industry despite a strong patent regime. So if anyone's going to be arguing that patent regimes are absolutely essential for building of industries, this is a clear example that you have to take into account the economic stage of the country in question before you can sort of advocate for strong patent protection and its beneficial impact on creating industries. So 1870 to 1970, full-fledged product patent regime, no industry. In fact, quite the contrary, no industry. All the drugs, most of the drugs were imported from abroad, and all of them came at really high prices because they were all imports. So in about 1950 to 1960, the government started rethinking this whole issue and said, look, this is not going the right way. We're not getting cheap drugs. We don't have an industry. And so what they did is they commissioned two people, essentially, to go and study the problem over the course of 1 or 2 years to find out how best they can tailor their legal regime and other regimes to ensure that they get cheaper drugs and that they build a domestic industry. So this committee of two judges essentially went around the country interviewing industry, interviewing groups, and they came to the conclusion that industry has strong chemistry skills, so they can basically take drugs and split them apart and find out how they work and then come up with alternative versions relying on different processes because they had strong organic chemistry skills. And therefore, let's try and incentivize them to actually reverse engineer drugs and to come up with generic versions. And so they put, so that was the regime in 1970. So they introduced a provision in the Patent Act saying no product patents for pharmaceuticals, only process patents. And as most of you know, a process patent is much, much weaker than a product patent because it's a generic company. It's quite easy for them to actually subvert a process patent. So, you know, it's pretty easy for them to come up with different processes. And to give you a good example, Cefaclor, which had about Eli Lilly's drug, and Eli Lilly had about 57 process patents over it because they, for some reason they couldn't get a product patent over this drug. And so they came up with 57 process patents to try and block off anyone from coming up with an alternative process. And Ranbaxy came up with the 58th one, which circumvented it. So just to give you an idea, the process patents are pretty weak. And so that helped the industry grow. I mean, it wasn't just the patent regime. It was also they had serious chemistry skills. So again, if the issue is, you know, how well does a legal regime help in creating an industry or in strengthening an industry, a legal regime has its limitations. I mean, you know, just because India did it this way, I'm not quite sure that countries that had no skilled chemistry personnel could have followed the same strategy and come up with a world-class generic industry. So because of this background, so you have essentially, you have a country that has taken a bold step, has experimented literally with the legal regime to try and see if it might work to help create an industry, and it worked. So in the 1990s, you found that generic companies in India were really getting stronger, were starting to serve a global market. Generics like Ranbaxy were entering the West in a big way. In the U.S., were entering the regulated generics markets in the U.S. and in Europe and doing pretty well. But 1995, you had TRIPS being signed on to, and a part of that equation was that India wanted stronger norms in copyright because it had the content industries that it was catering to. It had a strong Bollywood industry, and at the same time, it wanted open markets for textile goods and other goods that it was strong in. So WTO was a package, but still, I mean, as most of you familiar with the debate know, the information asymmetry was considerably strong. The developing countries, including India, did not exactly know what they were bargaining for because the information was incomplete. So when they bargained for TRIPS, I think most scholars would agree that there was considerable information asymmetry. And so it was seen as an inequitable instrument, and particularly in the area of pharmaceutical patents, you find a strong resistance to having norms that would mean stronger protection for pharmaceutical products. And you see this being played out right in the first case. I mean, the first TRIPS case that went up before a WTO panel involved India. The U.S. took India to the WTO alleging that it hadn't implemented what we call the mailbox provisions or the mailbox obligations under TRIPS, which were, for those of you not familiar with it, the mailbox obligation basically is that India and certain other developing countries were granted time till 2005 to introduce product patents in technology sectors that they didn't grant product patents on the date of signing of TRIPS, which is i.e. 1995. So all obligations under TRIPS come into effect, let's assume, in 1995. But for developing countries, you were granted a 10-year period to implement product patents in areas that you were not granting patents for earlier. So India had time till 2005 to implement product patents in pharmaceuticals. But in the interim, you had to accept applications for these patents, and you had to keep them in what is called a mailbox. And India hadn't given effect to that obligation. It hadn't introduced any provision in its patent regime that would give effect to that, and it was taken to the WTO, and the WTO came down pretty strongly in a strong decision stating that, yes, this is a definite obligation, and you haven't complied with it, so introduce a provision that will enable mailbox applications to be taken up by the patent office and to be kept in a manner and examined on in 2005 when India finally would transition to a product patent regime for pharmaceuticals. And then you have exclusive marketing rights, which is again a temporary sort of pipeline protection measure for some pharmaceutical drugs between 1995 and 2005. And you notice that, again, exclusive marketing rights, because of the strong resistance to TRIPS obligations, out of the 15 applications, only four were granted. And these are supposed to be almost automatic. I mean, exclusive marketing rights are not quite like patents. I mean, if you satisfy three conditions, you're pretty much, it's almost an automatic right. But because TRIPS was being strongly objected to, in fact, you had the Commerce Secretary going on record stating that, look, don't worry about this provision because we're not going to give effect to it, in a sense. Not as blatant as that, but pretty much that was his message to the industry. So as a result, in 2005, when the country had to introduce product patents in pharmaceuticals, it wasn't just going to have one provision there saying, okay, now we're going to grant product patents in pharmaceuticals. What it did was it introduced a number of other provisions that would in some way offset what they perceived as some of the negative effects of a product patent regime in pharmaceuticals. And so I'll take you through some of those provisions and the provisions that are safeguards, and then we'll try and examine how they fit within the TRIPS framework. And yeah, sorry, before I move on to that, the last time I made a similar presentation with that background, someone asked me if that was my wife or mother, and I just have to, that's actually one of the that's actually an Indian goddess. Those of you familiar with India know, like pretty much like the Greeks, we have a wide range of gods and goddesses, and that's actually the goddess of knowledge called Saraswati. And at the time that I was in India and IP was becoming a big thing, the standard talk was that intellectual property is nothing but a transition from knowledge to wealth. So you had another goddess of wealth called Lakshmi. So it was Saraswati to Lakshmi is what intellectual property is all about, till my professor at Oxford said, what about distributive justice? It's not just about knowledge to wealth. Where's the distribution? And so I knew that there was a huge encyclopedia of the gods and goddesses, so I looked it up, and sure enough, there was one for distributive justice as well. No, that's a he. But two of them are she, which actually is quite interesting that you had a IP gender seminar sometime back, right? So that might have fitted in well that two of the driving forces behind India's IP are goddesses and not gods.
We look forward to presenting that at an upcoming IP gender conference.
Perfect, yeah. So what are these safeguards, essentially? And as you can see, the pictures there were pretty much illustrate to you the kind of political controversy that ensued with the attempt to introduce product patents in pharmaceuticals. There was extremely strong opposition from patient groups, from public health activists, from the government. I mean, the government at the time had a really difficult time because it was supported on the outside by the left-wing parties, and the left-wing parties were pretty concerned with the introduction of product patents of pharmaceuticals. So what the government did was they passed an ordinance, and an ordinance is something that you can just slip by without getting the parliament to vote on it. So you get the president to sign off on it, and it lasts for about 6 months. So the government was concerned that if it waited to get this to parliament, the left parties may delay it, and the debates may be so delayed that it might not have complied with its obligation to introduce product patents in pharmaceuticals by 1/1/2005, which was the date granted to it by TRIPS. And so what it did was it just slipped it under as a presidential ordinance and hoped that it would get ratified in parliament after 6 months. So when it comes up in parliament, the left wasn't happy, and so they said, look, these are the safeguards we want in. And so they pushed about six provisions, and all the six provisions made it in exactly the form in which they suggested it. And those are the provisions that are really interesting because some of them find no parallel in any other part of the world. And we're waiting to see how it works out. in terms of it being interpreted in court and how it's given effect to. So, and one of the provisions, as you know, is now the center of controversy with Section 3D, which Novartis has challenged. Novartis has challenged the TRIPS compatibility and the constitutionality of that particular provision before an Indian court, saying it doesn't comply with TRIPS. And so that is one of the safeguards. So Section 3D is a refined patentability criteria. It's I would see it as a refined non-obviousness standard, really, to apply to pharmaceutical substances and chemical substances, because in pharmaceuticals you have this problem of the new chemical entity, and then you have all these different salt forms, and you have a history of pharmaceutical companies patenting the new chemical entity and then patenting different forms of that later to extend the monopoly. And so this is a provision that essentially tells you that if you just come up with a new form, we're not going to grant a patent unless you tell us or you show us how that new form is significantly better than what we had earlier. So if you sort of think of it within broad non-obviousness terms, this is a non-obvious standard. It's telling you that we consider all salts and other forms to be obvious unless you show us that it's got increased efficacy. So I'll take you through the Novartis dispute in detail in the next slide. The other thing is that the new regime has a very strong opposition mechanism. So if you're thinking patent oppositions, this is perhaps one of the most robust mechanisms, because you can oppose a patent application at the pre-grant level, before the patent is granted. If you don't succeed there, you can oppose it after the grant. You've got 1 year post-grant to oppose it. And if you still don't manage to knock it off, you can ask for a revocation of the patent at any time during the life of the patent. So it's a very, very robust mechanism. And in fact, I think it may be one of the few countries where public health groups have started using the opposition mechanism. So I have friends in India whose job it is, I mean, they're only studying the mailbox applications that have come in and the pharmaceutical applications with a view to knocking off the ones that are not really good, that don't comply with the patentability criteria. So so what you're seeing is you're not just seeing this as a private player dispute with, you know, competing pharmaceutical companies trying to oppose patent applications, but you see public health advocates and you see civil society groups involved in the opposition procedure as well, which is a relatively novel thing. You have an almost automatic compulsory licensing mechanism that would help generics. So, and that's a new provision introduced in 2005. So if a generic has been producing a drug, and let's assume that that drug is then patented because there's a patent application in the mailbox, and in 2005 the patent office has to open the mailbox and then decide whether that application is meritorious or not, and they decide that it is meritorious, it should be granted a patent. A generic company that has been producing the drug before 2005 can continue to produce that, which means it doesn't need to stop. It can continue producing that, provided it pays a reasonable royalty. And that's pretty much a compulsory license. I mean, in simple terms, that's a compulsory license. What you're saying is the generic can continue to produce a version of a patented drug, provided it pays a reasonable royalty. And then, of course, we have a very, very unique provision on parallel imports, which surprisingly hasn't been picked up by many, but I think that has serious TRIPS implications, but I'll just come to that in a second. Okay, so what's the framework really that we use when interpreting TRIPS? And this is something, again, most of you may be familiar with, but for those that are not, I'll just quickly run through it. So if you look at most of the WTO panel disputes, you find that there's a strong reliance on the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties to interpret TRIPS, because it is an international treaty, so it's pretty obvious that they would look to the Vienna Convention, which basically says under Article 31 that you have to look at the ordinary meaning of the term used in a treaty. So an ordinary meaning, a lot of them look to the dictionary, which is not quite helpful, but you find that there's considerable reliance on the dictionary. So much so that one of the commentators, Graham Deanwood, who teaches at Chicago Kent, last year wrote an article stating that Webster's has become the essential research tool for WTO panels. Of course, to be politically correct, I think they use both Webster's and Oxford English Dictionary as well. So Article 31 tells you, and Article 32 tells you, if you're not going to get too far with Article 31, which is determining the ordinary meaning, if you can't get too far with the dictionary or determining the ordinary meaning, then Then you can pick up negotiating history, et cetera, and go into all of that and try and see whether that helps you in interpreting the particular provision. And what we notice in most of the panel decisions, at least in the context of TRIPS, is that it's a very strict textual interpretation. And one is because they're relying on these dictionaries, and it's really driven by the fact that most of them recognize this as a political instrument, and they don't want to create controversy, right? So the safest way is to really take a very strict textual interpretation as opposed to a policy-oriented, broader dimensional interpretative approach. And that's also driven by the fact that you have a dispute settlement board rule that states that a WTO panel cannot add to or subtract from the obligations, which means it has to implement it in exactly the way it's stated there. And the safest way to do that is really to read it literally. In terms of flexibilities, you have Article 1 telling you that members are free to implement obligations in any manner as they deem fit. So you have, you know, these are certain obligations that TRIPS mentioned, but the way you implement that is completely up to you. And so you have a certain area of flexibility within which you can actually implement your obligations under TRIPS. So given that framework, let me take you through the Novartis case, which is right now one of the most controversial internationally. So Novartis's drug, which sells under the name Gleevec, is a very good drug. It's a very good drug for chronic myeloid leukemia, which is it's treated as an orphan drug in the U.S. because it impacts under 200,000 people, but it's a pretty serious condition, and this is possibly the best known cure that we have for it as of date. So the main Gleevec is the brand name, and the main molecule underlying Gleevec is something called imatinib mesylate, which was discovered in 1992. And then, as is common with patenting strategies of most pharmaceutical companies, what they did was they later discovered a beta crystalline form of this molecule in 1997, and they applied for a second patent. So the 1997 patent is under a mailbox process in India, right? Because 1995 to 2005, all the pharmaceutical applications that come into India are supposed to keep away in a mailbox, not to be open till 2005. But you have to protect it in the interim for novelty purposes and other purposes. So when they open it up in 2005, the patent office says that, look, this is an obvious form. This under 3D, this is a new form that has no added efficacy. So which means it does nothing more than what imatinib mesylate already did earlier. It has no added efficacy. Novartis tried claiming that, look, this beta crystalline form is actually more bioavailable. It's actually 30% more bioavailable than the earlier substance, so you should grant a patent. So under 3D, it is patentable because it's a new form that has increased efficacy. And the patent office said no, and that's being appealed now before the High Court. The patent office decision, unfortunately, is not a very well-reasoned one. So one is not quite sure whether it's a factual dispute in the sense that my understanding is that they weren't really convinced that it was 30% more bioavailable than the earlier form. Because if they were convinced with that, then it might be difficult to hold that, look, it's 30% more bioavailable, but it's still not efficacious. It still does not have increased efficacy. That might be difficult to sustain. So I'm guessing that it's really going to turn on the factual issue of whether it is 30% more bioavailable than the earlier form. So what does 3D really state? 3D says that the mere discovery of a new form of a known substance which does not result in the enhancement of the known efficacy of that substance is not patentable. So which means if there's an existing substance and all you've done is come up with a new form, which can include a salt form, an enantiomer formulation, polymorph, whatever you want to call it. So you come up with a new form of an existing substance, then the new form is patentable only if you show that the new form has increased efficacy over the old one, which means it's much more useful than what the earlier substance did. And that raises the obvious question, what exactly does efficacy mean? So in other words, if Novartis shows that it's 30% more bioavailable than the earlier form, is that increased efficacy? What level are you going to peg it at? Is 10% more bioavailable? Does that constitute increased efficacy? Or is 20% the minimum standard? And that's going to be difficult to really come up with standards in that regard. But what Novartis did, quite apart from challenging the patent controller decision saying it's bad on merits, is challenging Section 3D itself and saying that 3D is violates TRIPS, and 3D also violates the Constitution of India, because the Constitution contains a provision stating that you shall not have any law that is arbitrary. And they said this is an arbitrary standard. We have no guidelines on how to work this, and this is completely arbitrary. So if you look at Article 27 of TRIPS, in order to gauge whether their claim has any merit, Article 27 says patents shall be granted all inventions that are new, non-obvious, and have industrial applicability. Now, it doesn't define any of these terms. It doesn't define the term invention. It doesn't define the term new, non-obvious, or industrial applicability, meaning thereby that member states have some amount of flexibility in actually giving some meaning to these terms to decide what the non-obviousness standard needs to be. I mean, you can peg it as low as you want, or you can peg it as high as you want, within certain reasonable confines. And so if you look globally at what some of the tests are, you'll see that the U.S. test for a long time has been the suggestion motivation teaching test applied by the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit that is now being challenged as we speak. The Supreme Court may be actually coming down with the decision in KSR, and Josh was had filed an amicus in that case. Going by the hearing on the first day, it did seem like the Supreme Court is definitely going to not let it continue the way it is. To what extent they would change it is questionable, but I think the suggestion motivation teaching test is not going to stay in the form that it is, and it might be a slightly higher standard that they come down with. And because the Supreme Court is sitting in and reviewing the standard applied by the Court of Federal Circuit, you see the Court of Federal Circuit now trying to demonstrate to the Supreme Court that its standard is pretty robust. And you see that playing out in a decision that just came out, Pfizer v. Apotex, which involved Novask, you know, the drug Novask for hypertension, and the chemical entities, amlodipine, beside it. And so the court... Apotex challenged the secondary patent. Apotex challenged the patent on amlodipine besilate, stating that there was already an earlier patent for amlodipine, and the besilate form is an obvious one, which means any chemist could have come up with a besilate form. So the second patent is obvious in view of the first one, and because it involves certain known procedures of salt selection, and the court said, yes, it is obvious because any skilled person in the art could have narrowed it down to about six salts, and this is one of those six salts. And so in effect, if you look at Pfizer v. Apotex, it's pretty much doing what Section 3D does. I mean, 3D does it explicitly in a statutory form, and this does it through the general non-obviousness standard, but in a court of law. So to challenge the TRIPS compatibility of that is, I think, not going to get Novartis very far. And last week there was a conference at Fordham where we had a USTR representative, and one of the audience asked her as to what the USTR's position is on Section 3D. And she said, we don't have a position. And I said, that's a smart move, because given this ruling, I think for them to have a position would be, exactly. So it's interesting to see that. So in the UK, you have an old case involving a patent on a windsurfer, which is combining both sailing as well as surfing, an instrument that you see there, and it involved a patent on that. And they came up with a test for determining obviousness, which we now refer to as the windsurfer analysis. There were four questions that the court basically asked to determine whether something was obvious or not. And in the EU, they follow something called the problem-solution approach. So you see different tests being played out globally when in terms of determining non-obviousness. So you see a wide range of flexibility in actually implementing the non-obviousness standard throughout the world. And 3D is just one of those, is just one such standard that's being implemented in the context of pharmaceutical substances. And it's difficult, given this context, to see how a panel would buy into Novartis' argument that 3D violates TRIPS. Parallel imports, this is, again, this is a beautiful provision that I think might run into serious. I think the other provisions I'm sort of, I don't think a panel is really going to buy into those. This one might be a little serious. So before we read the provision, let me just give you, just look at the actual fact pattern there to help you appreciate the provision. So in a normal parallel import, as most of you know, normal parallel imports work in this way, if you see the left-hand side. So if you have Pfizer who's making a Viagra pill, let's say its cost is $10 to make a pill, and it sells it in India at $30, and it sells it in Bangladesh at $15, and because Bangladesh is poorer than India, so let's assume that there's some price differentiation there. And so because it's sold in Bangladesh at $15, someone called Abdul, who's a Bangladeshi exporter, exports it out to India, and Anand is the Indian importer who buys it from Abdul and then starts selling it in India at 20, right? So you have a classic case. So Pfizer selling in India at 30 and Anand selling the same drug in India at 20, and you know that Anand's pretty much going to get a good market because of this. And this is permissible under most legal regimes because this is a classic case of a parallel import. And you would say that there's been exhaustion here. The moment Pfizer puts its drug out in Bangladesh, its rights vis-a-vis that particular drug, patented drug, have been exhausted, international exhaustion. And therefore, it has no more control over where the drug goes or who sells it because it's been Pfizer's drug. It had the first call. It sold it. It's released that drug into the market internationally. And so that's your classical exhaustion. That's your classical parallel import provision. Now, what happens with the Indian provision is essentially this. Abdul can make his own pill, right? Let's say he calls it Genagra, generic Viagra. And then he makes it at $10, and he sells it to Anand, then Anand starts selling it at $15. I mean, look at the difference. I mean, this is going to hit Pfizer really hard. And that's essentially what the Indian provision enables you to do. So it says that it's not an infringement if you're importing a product from a person who's duly authorized under the law to sell it. So consider the classic situation where Bangladesh is a least developed country. It has time till 2016 to implement pharmaceutical product patents. So you have developing countries that were granted time till 2005, and you had least developed countries that were granted time till 2016. And so there's no patent in Bangladesh at the moment because it's availed of that flexibility. It's going to have it only in 2016. And Abdul is therefore free to make a generic version of Viagra in Bangladesh. And under this provision, because Abdul is duly authorized under the law to actually sell it in Bangladesh, because presumably Abdul just needs to get the drug regulatory approval, which he will. I mean, there's no patent issue. And so since he's duly authorized under the law to do that in Bangladesh, it's perfectly permissible for Anand to pick it up in India and to claim that it's not an infringement under Section 107A. So, like I said, brilliant provision, but... if you were to ask the question of whether it's exhaustion, right? Because all TRIPS tells you is nothing in this agreement shall be used to address the issue of exhaustion of intellectual property rights, which means insofar as... I'm sorry about that. Insofar as exhaustion is concerned, we're not going to interfere with you, with your flexibility. But the question is this exhaustion? Has the right been exhausted here? It's not the case that Pfizer already put its drug out on the market. In this case, Pfizer hasn't done that. It's Abdul basically making a generic version of Viagra to begin with. And that's an interesting question. So what is it? And so it raises the other issue of how flexible TRIPS really is. I mean, we talk of TRIPS flexibilities, but quite obviously it's not completely flexible. There must be some sort of bounds to how flexible it really is. And just soon after the negotiation of TRIPS, this is an interesting comment made actually by the Minister of Commerce then, who looked at the document and then said, "We're all aware that the text of TRIPS is a masterpiece of ambiguity, couched in the language of diplomatic compromise, resulting in a verbal tightrope walk with a prose remarkably elastic and capable of being stretched all the way to Geneva." So, and you see that, I'll take you to some of the other provisions where you really have problems figuring out as to what the provisions mean. Compulsory licensing, this is another safeguard that was introduced. And as you know, compulsory licensing is now being looked at very closely in view of the Thai controversy that's now going on. So Section 11A under the new act basically enables a generic to continue producing the drug, although the drug is now patented, provided it pays a reasonable royalty. And the question is now, would something like that be TRIPS compatible? And to answer that, I think you have to look at Article 31 of TRIPS and the fact that Article 31 really does not lay down the grounds for invoking compulsory licenses. And that's a huge flexibility. So 31 basically tells you that if you issue a compulsory license, there are certain conditions that you need to comply with. But it doesn't tell you as to the circumstances under which you can actually issue the license. And I think there's considerable flexibility there, and which is why I personally think Thailand is completely within its rights to do what it did. The interesting question then is, what is adequate remuneration? What is going to be a reasonable royalty? Because TRIPS also tells you in Article 31 that when you issue compulsory licenses, in most cases, barring emergency and public non-commercial use, you pretty much have to first negotiate with the patent owner, and it should be voluntary negotiation, and you should attempt a voluntary license first. If that fails, then you come on and apply for a compulsory license. And if you do issue a compulsory license, it has to be based on adequate remuneration. I mean, the remuneration has to be adequate. And that's an interesting question, and we might see that being played out much later in the courts, and I'm sure there'll be considerable disputes in terms of what a reasonable royalty rate really is. Because they're, you know, compulsory licensing, there haven't been too many cases for a couple of reasons in India. One is that, you know, it was generic companies really didn't need a compulsory license earlier. I mean, they could just subvert the process. But right now with the pharmaceutical product patent regime, I think you're going to find an increased pressure by the generics to actually avail of more compulsory licenses. And the second reason is it's procedurally quite difficult to work. So a compulsory license is administratively quite cumbersome. And in one of the cases in 1977, a third party applied for a compulsory license on a patented technology. The patent owner challenged it. It was decided first by the patent controller. Then it went up in appeals. It went up in 3 different appeals, and by the time it reached the Supreme Court of India, the patent had expired, so which means it didn't make sense anymore. And so when you see procedural bottlenecks of that sort really accounted for the low level of compulsory licensing in India till date. So in 2005, what they say is that when you're voluntarily negotiating for a voluntary license, you have to complete those negotiations in 6 months. We cap it at 6 months so that the patent owner does not delay the negotiations and thereby try and make sure that that an application for a compulsory license is rendered infructuous. The other provision is one on local working, which is, again, a controversial provision. I personally think it's TRIPS compatible. The U.S. tried taking Brazil to the WTO on a similar provision, but they backed off, we didn't have a panel decision on that. And local working, for those of you who may not know what this provision means, is that if the patent owner does not locally work the patent in the particular country, so for example, if Pfizer has a patent in India on a certain drug, if it does not actually manufacture the drug in India, but it only imports it into India, then Ranbaxy, which is a generic company in India, can go to the patent controller and say, I need a license because this patent is not locally being worked in the country. And that's a ground under the Patent Act, that if you're not locally working it, and the idea being that, look, if we're going to give you a patent, then some benefits have to accrue to the local economy. And one of the ways that accrues is by you actually working it. So you're hiring the local force here, presumably some technology transfer, et cetera, et cetera. And so a lot of people say that's not really TRIPS compatible because Article 27 tells you that you cannot discriminate between a patent owner who imports and a patent owner who locally works the patent. Not entirely true because TRIPS incorporates large parts of the Paris Convention, and the Paris Convention pretty much treats treats someone who doesn't locally work the patent as an abuse of the patent itself. So it comes close to treating it as an abuse. And I think because of the incorporation of the Paris Convention within TRIPS, it's a fair argument to make that it's TRIPS compatible, that if you have a local working provision, it's TRIPS compatible because it's a good way to encourage tech transfer, et cetera. And so the local working provision is present in the Indian regime as well, but I think that's not something that's likely to be challenged because of this alternative interpretation, which I think is a strong one. Even if we don't have enough compulsory licensing cases post 2005, I think what it'll really do is, as we see in the case of Brazil, that it really induces voluntary licensing, or it induces a reduction in prices. So Brazil pretty much uses it as a stick. It says, okay, we're going to issue the license. And once there's a credible threat of issuing the license, the pharmaceutical company in question will automatically reduce the prices. So, and that's an interesting question, again, to ask for patent policy, because it's sort of indirectly achieving a price reduction. So if you just have a normal price regulation mechanism which works well, then you may not want to go this route because that's more direct, that's much more simple. Whereas in a large number of compulsory licensing cases, what you're noticing is the actual intent is really to get the prices to drop. And you see that working beautifully in Brazil. Okay, this is, again, a very controversial part of TRIPS Article 39.3 and demands for data exclusivity. So for those of you not familiar with this area, as you know, for a pharmaceutical drug to come out on the market, it needs regulatory approval in most countries. So typically in the U.S., you would need approval from the FDA, Food and Drug Administration. And to gain that approval, you submit a whole lot of data, clinical trial data and other data, to show that your drug is actually safe and effective. So Pfizer, let's say, applies for approval for its drug Lipitor, which, as you know, is the best-selling drug. It grosses about $10 billion a year, just one drug. And the entire net worth of the Indian industry is $4 billion. So just one drug of Pfizer gets them $10 billion. And so they submit all this data to the regulator showing that Lipitor is safe and effective. And the regulator says yes, and it grants an approval. Now, Ranbaxy comes along and says, look, I've got the same. Let's assume the Lipitor patent now is no longer valid. So Ranbaxy comes along and says that I've got a generic version of, which is the exact same copy of Lipitor, but I haven't done all these tests because it doesn't make sense, right? I mean, someone has already done the test. Why should I go around wasting resources and harming more people in the process and conducting tests on all of them? You already have data with you. So can you rely on the data you already have to approve me? Some of the regulatory regimes would tell you that all you need to show is that you're bioequivalent to Pfizer's drug. So all Ranbaxy has to show is that, look, I'm bioequivalent. It's exactly the same molecule that I have or the active ingredient that I have. And so any data that applies to the main molecule or the brand company molecule should apply to me as well. So I don't even need to look at the data. And so the US, EU, and the others argue that under 39.3, you have to grant an exclusive right over that data, which means Ranbaxy cannot come for 5 years and rely on the data, whether directly or indirectly. So Ranbaxy cannot make the argument that, look, I'm bioavailable, therefore rely on the data that Pfizer submitted to you. Because what they're saying is under 39.3, that data is the exclusive property of Pfizer. So you're supposed to protect it, let's say, for 5 years, or in Europe, they protect for about 8 years. And other countries dispute that interpretation of Article 39.3, and they say, look, it's not really calling for exclusivity. What it's saying is that you should protect it against unfair commercial use, and none of these terms are defined. So unfair commercial use essentially means that I should ensure that the data doesn't slip out of the regulator's office, which means Ranbaxy does not get direct access to the data, but it's perfectly okay for me to approve Ranbaxy's generic version. I just asked Ranbaxy for bioequivalence data, and then I look at the data that Pfizer's already submitted, and I say, you've got the approval, which means I rely on Pfizer's data, but I don't disclose Pfizer's data to Ranbaxy. And so given these two opposite ways in which to interpret Article 39.3, the interesting question is, what is the real standard? And I think exclusivity is an argument that may not hold much water. And exclusivity is data exclusivity. So the US, EU, Australia, New Zealand, and Israel, amongst the main countries that actually provide for data exclusivity. If you actually look at the history, again, when you go back, and this is an area where I think you can pretty much, where a panel is likely to go back to negotiating history. And if you look at the history, the earlier draft before TRIPS clearly provided for exclusivity. I mean, if you read it, this is a clear exclusivity provision. It says, unless the person submitting the information agrees, which is unless Pfizer agrees, the data may not be relied upon, It's not disclosed, may not be relied upon for the approval of competing products. I mean, that is as direct can be. And this draft never made it to the final version of TRIPS, thereby clearly indicating that what member states wanted was a more flexible approach to interpreting 39.3. They didn't want a clear data exclusivity norm. At the same time, you have countries arguing for what I call permissive reliance, which means that the data can be relied on. The data should not be disclosed, but it can be relied on, which again is a standard that I'm not completely comfortable with for the simple reason that if the standard is merely one of not disclosing, then one is you're rendering Article 39.1 and 2 redundant, because 39.1 and 2 really provide for circumstances, normal circumstances of trade secrets, where trade secrets are meant to be protected and not disclosed. And 39.3 is really the specific one that's applying to pharmaceutical regulatory data. And if you go back to the clause itself, 39.3 says, in addition, members shall protect such data against disclosure. Thereby meaning that when they use the term unfair commercial use, they're obviously meaning a standard higher than disclosure. Because when someone says in addition, that means that the primary standard is one of protecting against unfair commercial use, and the secondary standard is one against disclosure. So to therefore argue that you can rely on the data because your only obligation is not to disclose it, which means don't show Ranbaxy the data, but rely on it, seems a little problematic to me. And therefore, the interesting question is, what is the standard? Could we have a standard that's based on a compensatory liability model, which is that you can, that Ranbaxy can rely on the data, but it has to pay Pfizer something? Because so it's not an exclusivity. So exclusivity would mean Ranbaxy cannot rely on the data at all. Compensatory liability would be you can rely on the data, or you can ask the regulator to rely on the data, but you have to pay something to. You have to share in the cost that Pfizer. You have to share in Pfizer's cost in generating the data, because Pfizer presumably, went through a lot of cost and effort before it got the data, and let's work out a sharing mechanism. And we have a couple of mechanisms that are in operation, and I'm actually currently working on one such mechanism, and I'll go into the details maybe another time. Since we're running on short on time, so I'm sorry that I don't have a conclusion because, heavily as I've thought about it, I only have questions at the end and no ready answers. So one of the things we really want to ask is, and you notice this with India, with Brazil, and with some of the countries that I would like to categorize as innovative developing countries, which is really a developing country that has significant technological expertise in certain areas, but is a developing country in every other sense, because if you look at India, 26% below poverty line, but extremely strong IT sector, strong pharmaceutical industry, a growing biotech industry. And so there's a growing demand from within to raise IP norms. But at the same time, you have 26% below poverty line. You have no statewide health insurance. And you have all these different concerns. You have concerns on biodiversity, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's a strong pull on either side to, one, to go in for stronger IP norms, and the other to try and somehow mitigate the impact of patents. And as a result of this tension, you see a set of norms evolving in these countries that are quite different than what we see elsewhere. So you saw the parallel import provision, which is quite a novel one. You see an automatic compulsory licensing provision that you don't find anywhere. And you find patentability criteria that may or may not be similar, but at the statutory level, it's pretty clear that they're much more stringent than existing norms. And so is that really reflective of the fact that these are innovative developing countries that are really struggling with how best to make use of these regimes? Because it's not a standard, we're a developing country, stronger norms don't matter to us. It's a more carefully calibrated approach now, as some norms might make sense to us, others may not, so let's try and balance it out. The other question that we might want to think about is, given the Doha Declaration and the focus on public health explicitly in a written text that's a sort of addendum to the TRIPS text, will panels that are deciding issues now do a broader policy analysis, because now they've been asked to explicitly read TRIPS in consonance with public health? And public health is, again, not textual, right? It's policy. And so if you have future disputes before WTO panels, are they going to incorporate more of a policy-oriented approach? How is that going to play out? And especially in the area of pharmaceutical patents and public health, it may not get you too far to adopt a strict textual approach, because there are no answers there. The other question is, will an action be brought? I mean, we saw all the problematic provisions, and the interesting question is the U.S. or the EU or Japan going to bring an action on any one of these provisions? Goes back to the issue of how flexible is TRIPS. I mean, they would bring a case, presumably, only if it's really strong, because if they bring a weak case, they might get a standard. They might lose it and get a standard that other countries might pick up. So Article 39.3, I think, and my sense is that they may not bring a case against any country, because if they get a ruling that it doesn't stand for exclusivity, it could potentially impact, it could potentially lead a lot of other countries to not then incorporate data exclusivity norms in their national legislations. And it could also impact the U.S. drive to actually have this norm in the FTAs, in the free trade agreements. And that raises another interesting question. Because the U.S. has been signing so many free trade agreements, calling for data exclusivity within that agreement, and thereby trying to raise the standard globally, because the moment, let's assume, if Chile signs an FTA with the U.S., and under the FTA, Chile is obligated to provide for data exclusivity, although TRIPS doesn't require that, the argument is that Chile, under TRIPS, Chile should maintain the same standard for all countries, all WTO members, because of the most favored nation clause. And therefore, is that an attempt to actually raise up the standard globally, and then to argue that, look, all states follow the standard, therefore 39.3 really is a exclusivity standard? And, of course, the other interesting question is, even if an action is brought and India loses, will India comply? What are the mechanisms for ensuring compliance? And the brilliant example, of course, is, as those of you familiar with WTO disputes know, the U.S. Lost a case on homestyle exemptions in the copyright area. Until date, they haven't changed the law to comply with that. So I was actually at Fordham, one of the panels was discussing China and TRIPS, and in the context of the fact that a WTO action was brought against China for copyright enforcement, you know, saying that they lack enforcement mechanisms in copyright. Sir Hugh Laddie, who'd been one of the most prominent patent judges in the UK and now is chairing the IP department at University College, said, you know, I would advise China to do exactly what the United States did, which is, you know, lose the case and then don't comply with it. So there's several reasons for that. I mean, I think what the non-compliance by the U.S. really demonstrates is that if your domestic industry really puts pressure, there's nothing much you can do. And I think a little bit of that will play out in India and China and all these contexts. The domestic sector is pretty strong. And in a country like India, if you have the left parties sort of supporting the government from the outside, it's difficult to see how, if they don't want a certain standard, how the government is actually going to comply with it. And then you have the countervailing considerations that countries like India and Brazil are taken to the WTO on TRIPS issues, on IP issues. And at the same, on the other hand, countries like India and Brazil actually file actions against the U.S. and EU on other aspects of WTO, which is, you know, open market access to goods, such as. So the number of actions where the subsidy norms by the U.S. and EU have been challenged by Brazil and India, on particularly on textiles, et cetera. So India and Brazil want open market access for some of their raw materials that go out of these countries. And there are a couple of rulings where the panels have held that the U.S. and EU are in contravention of WTO norms on subsidies and on anti-dumping And there's been no compliance there. So it's sort of, so one may offset the other. So, okay, we're getting a ruling against you here, but we've got a ruling against you on this side. And so they may just offset each other, and that may work into the dynamics of future actions and prospect of future actions. So I think that's about it. I have nothing further. I'm happy to take questions.
Just say, you know, two comments and then just ask a question about the compulsory licensing regime. One comment is that 3D is interesting because if you look at some of the old Supreme Court cases in the U.S., what they actually said was even improving the function is not enough for an inventive step. You have to have a new function.
Right.
3D seems to say by enhanced efficacy that improvement is enough. So one could argue that is a very conservative and therefore very TRIPS compliant measure. Second, in regard to parallel imports, it's a really tough issue, I agree, but it goes back to the literalism question. Yeah. Import can't mean that you haven't triggered the U.S. right, because if so, you would never have an exhaustion issue.
Right.
So then the question is, if it's not just triggering the U.S. right, what basis is there to distinguish between whether the foreign activity is one that the patent holder authorized or is compulsorily licensed or is simply not regulated?
That's a pretty interesting. I mean, the only reason I say it might be is because, I mean, if you look at, let's just go to the parallel import provision. Yeah. Okay. So now Article 6.
Right.
Now Article 6 is an exception to Article 28 that says you have, a patent owner has the exclusive right to make, import, manufacture, distribute, et cetera, and import is one of the exclusive rights granted under Article 28. And Article 6 seems to be an exception to that, saying that nothing shall be used to address the issue of exhaustion, which means insofar as anything relates to exhaustion, then we're not going to hold you to Article 28. So the question is this exhaustion?
Well, it is or it isn't. I mean, it also could be viewed as simply an interpretive principle for the agreement. That nothing, no rights in the agreement prejudice the issue. So then the question is literalism in regard to import,
or right, in regard to exhaustion?
Literalism in regard to how one interprets 28 import.
Right.
And if you're not going to take a literal approach to any import, then it gets very hard to distinguish between what imports are do or don't trigger the import right. That's all. So you're saying
don't even look at exhaustion, just look at import. And so if a generic version comes from Bangladesh, it's not really an import.
Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But I don't see how if it is an import, then it's going to be hard to justify that the foreign license sale is also. It also should be an import. Yeah. So and the U.S. takes that position. It doesn't matter what you do overseas. Mm-hmm. But that can't be the rule because that would exclude any possibility of exhaustion.
Right.
So that's all I'm saying is it really goes back to the interpretive principles you apply and how literal and what policies, and that goes back to, say, practice. And there, I guess, I think that particularly on the obviousness issue, there's no good state practice argument that's going to take things down.
Yeah.
The last thing is just in terms of compulsory licensing, it really goes to how they implement it. Do you think that it's going to be a basis for actually compelling the pharmaceutical industry to disclose information about their costs of R&D and profits?
Oh, that's
may find no challenges to the licenses.
Yeah, I think that's a very very interesting question, and I think that's why pharma may oppose anything related with compulsory licensing, including the one on data. You know, if you have a compulsory licensing model for data exclusive, I mean, on regulatory data, my guess is Pfizer may be happier with the current existing Indian law, which just provides protection against non-disclosure. But the moment you tell them that, look, we're going to take it one step higher and actually compensate you for the data, they might actually say, no, we're not interested, because that forces us to release cost.
Exactly.
And we really don't want to do that. So I think you're absolutely right. Compulsory licensing, because of its tendency to actually get them to release data, you might find that, it raises the question, I mean, what is the purpose of driving that compulsory license? I mean, In Brazil, it seems to me to drive down the prices. In India, you've got the countervailing consideration of actually generics wanting to do it. It's not just a question of driving prices down, but you know, generics really want to get into the game. So if it's just a question of driving down prices and pharma companies don't want to release cost, then they would drive down the prices immediately because they don't want a license. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the Indian context, I think it may be a little more...
Right, and I guess the question is, what will the Indian regulators do if pharma simply doesn't show up in the proceeding to set the price?
Well, I think they'll take a unilateral. I mean, that's what they've done in most cases. If you don't show up, then you know, then we set the price depending on whatever we think is right.
Yeah.
And I think that's...
Why don't we go around and why don't we use the mic so the people who are going to watch this subsequently get the benefit of the questions.
Yeah.
Sean, and send it down.
So let me follow up on that. Another a question on the data compulsory license liability regime. So several other people are working in this area, like often the kind of left. So Jamie and Rob Wiseman are working on this same kind of idea parallel. I mean, there may be intricacies where you guys are different, but the one move that you've made that they're not moving is this may be required by TRIPS.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Now you seem to be going.
Absolutely.
So you're now in divergence with Carlos Correa.
Absolutely.
In
fact, I had
a lot of people.
Yeah.
I wonder if you'd comment on that. I mean, so one possible I don't completely get your textual argument.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, one possible interpretation that would allow for not TRIPS exclusivity would be the first clause is really about theft. It's really about traditional trade secrets. It says there shall be unfair commercial use, and you trace that back to the Paris Convention, which is actually about trade secrets.
Yeah.
It's not about exclusivity.
Absolutely.
And the second provision is about government disclosure, and the second part of the clause, as you know, is unless it's protected by other means. It seems to me, I mean, one of the things that U.S. states are looking at doing is forcing you to put your clinical trial data on the website, and the other means that we use in the states to prevent, you know, the harm of disclosure is an exclusivity regime. We actually have exclusivity here. So one interpretation would be if you have exclusivity, then you can require them to put it on the website.
Yeah.
If you don't, then you can't require them to put it on the website, but you can still allow use. So a chance to motivate further on your own interpretation of why you think TRIPS may actually
You're absolutely right. In fact, I had prolonged discussions with Carlos and I think Rob Wiseman as well on this issue because I think my starting point was that I think this is pretty much required under 39.3. I wasn't too convinced with Carlos's argument that you can basically rely you can have a standard of permissive reliance, which is that it's okay for you to have a regime where runbacks you can come up and rely on the data, and your only obligation was to protect the data against non-disclosure, which is essentially what Carlos and the others seem to be stating, that, look, the standard is that you don't disclose this data, or you ensure that it's not leaked out, or there's no breach of confidence, or there's no dishonest procurement of the data. And it seemed like 39.2 and 1 are exactly on that. I mean, you can pretty much bring dishonest procurement and everything else within 39.1 and 2. You don't need 39.3 to do. And so if you can do that under 1 and 2, then you have, again, a WTO interpretative norm which says you can't adopt a reading, which is essentially what they say, you can't adopt a reading that would result in reducing whole clauses or paragraphs redundancy. And so...
In the other alternative constructions about government disclosure. So trade secret is usually you don't disclose it to anyone.
Yeah.
Now you've disclosed it to the government, but the government can't disclose. Because isn't 39.3...
Yeah, but 39.2 and 1 is really not restricted to private parties. It says any party. So under your interpretation, I mean, one could state that if the government enters into a contract, or the government enters into a deal with a private party, then it can disclose all data without contravening 1 and 2, which is not the case. The government's pretty much subject to 1 and 2. I mean, I don't see how a government could be exempt from 1 and 2, which is essentially my starting point. But if the government could be, then I would buy into that argument. I mean, two reasons. One is I think 39.1 and 2 applies to all the cases that Carlos and the others put forward as what 39.3 stands for. And the other one is that that if you look at the first clause, yeah, I mean, if you look at this in addition, I mean, you're absolutely right. So if I have an exclusivity norm, or if I have a compensatory liability norm, and I say that's enough to comply with my obligation to protect it against unfair commercial use, then yeah, I can go and put it outside. I can disclose it as much as I want. And that's what the second part really tells you. But in addition to that, what the second part really hints at is that the disclosure norm is a secondary norm. I mean, if you read the structure of 39.3, and you see that it's first telling you that you shall protect against unfair commercial use, then it's telling you in addition. And so it seems to suggest that disclosure is really the secondary, norm, which you don't even need to comply with once you comply with one. I mean, and that's exactly what you raised, that the moment you comply with one, you don't even need to comply with two. Because you can disclose as much as you want, provided you protected it against unfair commercial use. And given that scenario, it's obviously cannot be the case that 39.3, the only standard is one of disclosure or non-disclosure. It has to be something more than that.
Next question. But let me just ask one question. Yeah. Again, it goes back to liberalism and state practice. Unfair commercial use, then, yeah. How does one define it? Literally, it says it would be unfair for the government to use the data.
Yeah.
And it's not clear there was any norm in place that was unfair.
Yeah, I mean.
And let me give you a concrete example.
Yeah.
What the Monsanto takings case says is if the government makes it a condition of your submission, it's not an unconstitutional condition, then there's no taking.
Yeah.
So what makes it state practice that kind of restriction then is unfair?
See, it's, one is trying to get the standard from the article states to actually look to state practice and to imply a standard from state practice. State practice is a very high norm. Under WHO jurisprudence, you have to pretty much show that there's near consensus in state practice to actually say, okay, state practice is determinative of what the standard is. And clearly you don't have that here. So you have two divergent views. So you have views of countries that say, look, this calls for exclusivity. You have countries that say that the government is perfectly fine to rely on it. And the question is, what is the right standard? And so if you see, so what I'm saying is based on the reading and the structure of this article, you have what seems like two opposite ends of the spectrum. And my reading is the standard somewhere in between. And one of that in-between things is compensatory liability. I can't think of anything else that would actually fall in between those things. In between just a straightforward non-disclosure obligation and an obligation to actually protect it as an exclusive property. And the only one that seems that has come to my mind as lying in between is a compensatory liability model. But otherwise, state practice, the problem with state practice is its countries are divided on the issue. So I don't know how much you can rely on that to then say that this is.
Right, so you're back to an unclear.
Absolutely.
Question. Right. Why don't you use the mic so that.
Well, when it comes to the enforceability mechanism that exists in India, we all know, as you yourself stated, the patent also got lost its age.
Yeah, exactly.
In the process. So knowing very well the Indian scenario, the Novartis case, and especially the document that has been filed in the Novartis case by none other than Novartis itself, relying on the document submitted by the so-called patent man of India, who said that it's all a violation.
He never said that.
In the recent report submitted by the team, where Mr. Mashalkar has headed, not relating to Novartis case, on the new inventive step, when he has defined based on the several empirical data that he has collected by collecting information from almost every corner of the world, wherein he said that even an isomer is considered to be a new entity, chemical entity.
Right?
Mm-hmm. So, and he says, in case of not providing this provision in the Indian Patent Act, it will be a violation of the TRIPS agreement, right? Suddenly the Indian government has dumped him. So what happens to the report that has been submitted as an expert in this field? Because the entire now scenario on the Novartis case revolves around the same report that has been submitted as the representative of government, as a government appointed agency, and now that the next day he claims that, okay, he has performed perjury. right. submission of his report.
Right.
But what happens? Imagine the international, the entire world is watching India.
Right.
So what happens in such a case where it comes to trips and so many big talks that we have, especially the ornamental value yeah. that the Patent Act or the patent regime yeah. has projected to the world that, yeah. okay, it's just the sake of showing to others yeah. that we have complied.
Right.
And the second one is yeah. on the data related matters,
yeah.
India has now started
yeah.
the clinical research. It's an outsourcing business that mm-hmm. has taken a big shape in the Indian context.
Mm-hmm.
The clinical research trials,
right.
the new drug discovery, you mm-hmm. know, experiments or the, you know, so many so much of investment is being
right.
has been already been done in the Indian market
mm.
and the contract manufacturing.
Mm.
So when it comes to the TRIPS,
mm.
okay, it doesn't prescribe on any particular aspects related to
mm.
the data related issues
right.
because ultimately the usage of the drugs
yeah.
will be centered for particular countries
mm.
wherein the regulatory systems that prevail in those countries are answerable, whereas the manufacturing takes place in Indian context.
Right.
So there are several issues. The Indian regulator doesn't have any role, or does he have any role? What happens in such cases? So these are two major issues. I think the entire world is watching on the relevance of TRIPS on the Indian pharmaceutical industry as such. Knowing very well about its past or its present way of functioning, you know.
No, yeah, I think you're, you know, take your second question first. I think it's a very, very interesting issue because of this almost one-sided focus on patents. The regulatory aspect has been completely forgotten, and there's serious issues there, particularly since we have not just a federal sort of regulatory approach, but a statewide regulatory approach. And you have forum shopping for state regulators that are very, very lax, and you have drugs that don't really meet quality standards. In the outsourcing context, you're right. A lot of clinical trial research is moving to India, which raises questions on informed consent, I think, more than it raises on anything else, because they're going to populations that may not exactly appreciate what they're giving away when they sign up to these trials. More than that, the central regulator is now being advised by the FDA from here on how to revamp everything. So I'm not sure how that's going to play out. But in terms of facilities in India itself, as you know, outside the U.S., the most number of FDA-approved facilities are in India. So as presumably the big players are already compliant because they're actually selling for global markets. The question is the small players. And the small players, when I was assessing the impact of the patent regime on them, almost all of them unanimously, their only concern was how to comply with regulation, which, you know, they thought they were going to be non-competitive if the regulation got a little more tighter. And I think that was the primary concern. And I think there's a definite move towards making the regulation structure a little stronger to see that the drugs are safer when they come out.
Import provisions may also exacerbate the question.
Yeah, you're right, because you don't know what. Yeah, exactly. So I think there's a move towards that, but you're right. There's some serious concerns that unfortunately haven't been looked into because of this almost one-sided focus on patents. Coming to your first, I actually had a slide on that, which I didn't do because I don't know if you're aware, but there was the report that the paper that he allegedly plagiarized from was mine. Yeah, I'll come to that. I mean, see, the thing is, okay. Now, so the term of reference was whether it be TRIPS, this was a proposed amendment that the government wanted to introduce, which would have gone beyond 3D. In fact, would have made this the most unique patent regime ever, because it would have said that, can you limit the grant of pharmaceutical patents to just new chemical entities, which means nothing else is patentable? And so it wasn't really about 3D, and I don't think the report said anything about it, but the media made a huge fuss about it, as is normally the case, and Novartis basically tried to blind the court by relying on this report and saying, look, this report says that it's that some provisions in the Indian Patent Act are not TRIPS compatible, and we think they're pointing to 3D. So Novartis was trying to boost its case by relying on this report, whereas this report was actually concerned only with whether if you limited patents to new chemical entities, whether that would be TRIPS compatible. And this committee said, no, that wouldn't be TRIPS compatible because you have, you know, in the pharmaceutical, I mean, it wasn't a well reasoned, it was quite a shoddy report. And they sort of lifted conclusions that I had for Batim without taking the reasons. But
we can say your report was not shoddy.
Was not.
Your analysis.
So it was restricted to this one issue, which is if you change your patent regime and have a section that says that only new chemical entities are patentable, would that be TRIPS compatible? And somehow Novartis said that implies that 3D is not TRIPS compatible, which is totally false. And the report being withdrawn, I think it's a nonsensical effort, really. I mean, which country really goes out asking for whether its law complies with TRIPS? I mean, it's a, you know, does the US do it? Does the EU do it? They pretty much do what the hell they want to do, and then you wait for someone to, you know, if a challenge comes up, then you see how it works out. This was what I would call an attempt by the government to prevent a stalling effort. So the left parties wanted this provision in, and the government said, look, we're not clear it's TRIPS compatible, so let's avoid it for the moment. Let's just push it to a committee that will decide on it. And so the committee is literally a scapegoat, and then the committee sits on it for a year and a half. A better way to go about this, which is why I think I'm quite happy with the committee report not being taken up by the government, because it anyway doesn't say much. It's a shoddy report, and it doesn't do much policy-wise. So what you want is really a policy committee that would decide on broader policy issues that would say, okay, these are our concerns. Now, what is the standard for efficacy? How is this going to play out? Let's evolve some norms in that regard. Let's find out how we can ensure that off-patented generics are still on the market, because there are huge issues here. You know, because of the marketing power of the brand name pharmaceuticals, theoretically, although off-patent generics could be on the market, they're not. Sometimes state law prohibits pharmacists from substituting. I mean, those are the sort of concerns you need to address in terms of figuring out what you're going to do if you want to ensure better access to medicines in the country, rather than a narrow TRIPS interpretative issue, which I don't think gets anyone anywhere.
Did you have another question? Yes. We'll finish. Can you use the mic?
Even if Novartis succeeds in their appeal, what prevents Indian companies from going to using the parallel import provision and going to Bangladesh and stuff to actually produce there?
Well, they can.
They can?
Ah, absolutely. Bangladesh doesn't have the only problem is how feasible is that? Does Ranbaxy have to go and set up a unit there? Because the Bangladeshi pharma industry is pretty well developed, though not quite at the same level as the Indian industry. So the question is, how would you work that in Bangladesh? Would it have the technology base to really produce to help you get drugs manufactured there? If that's possible, then this works pretty much. Yeah.
Thank you again for very comprehensive.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you for your comments. Yeah, very interesting comments.
Let's get you some lunch.